When I'm with the baby, I go out of my head and I just can't get enough. I
I
just
just
can't
can't
get
get
enough.
enough. Depeche Mode.
Yes.
Yes.
I saw that you were rocking it old school, listening to some cassette tapes.
That's right. I'm going all retro, man.
Yeah, all analog.
That's right. None of this digital shit. I'm even recording this episode on a cassette tape.
Nice. We're actually talking on landline telephones right now.
Yeah, no, we're
And
using two tin cans and
yeah.
huge string.
From clubhouse to clubhouse, Geek Brunch Retrocast. No, I saw that you were listening to that cassette tape, and we actually played that song. We actually had that song on our list of songs for our DJ to play at our wedding.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so I thought there was some nice synchronicity going on there.
Very cool. You didn't have them do the Steve Miller Band, Abracadabra?
No. Though, you'll be glad to hear that Kara was equally surprised that I was not familiar with that song.
Wow.
Yeah, I played it
Did
for
she
her.
see me in Alan's rendition?
Yep. She saw all the videos.
That was fun.
Yeah, that was funny. She was shaking my head, so, or yeah, she was shaking my head. No. Freudian slip. Yeah, we saw. So you posted a video on my Facebook of you and Alan singing that song and singing our two features from last episode, basically our two song selections.
Yeah.
And then the video with all you guys out on the streets of Baltimore.
Yeah, the streets.
That video was funny because I watched it once and then I watched it a second time, thinking I know I saw a barb at the beginning of this video. What happened there? So I watched it a second time to see where she disappeared to, and I realized that she starts off with everybody at the beginning of the video, and then she quickly just kind of wanders off to the side, shaking her head. And
Yeah,
I
because
heard her say, "Oh, Daryl."
Daryl. And
So,
Daryl's just saying, do some of this. Do some of this.
yeah, she's like, "Now, who was the one who was making the obscene hand gestures again?" She wanted to make sure she remembered his name. Just wanted to get it straight. No, but that was awesome. That was awesome. You remember to do that. That was cool.
It was a fun time.
Yeah. But yeah, Baltimore is a cool city. And well, we both had stuff going on last weekend. You were at the Baltimore Comic Con once again.
Yes. It was I was there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. But the con was only Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But we had a meet up on Thursday night, which was a lot of fun. At
That's cool.
a barbecue, or no, at a wings place.
Yeah, some of my friends from that came in from out of town, they made sure to stop and get some wings while they were here.
Yeah.
And my buddy apparently realized for the first time, my college friend, he's from Maine originally, and I guess all this time he'd been thinking that buffalo wings were from a really large breed of chicken called buffalo chickens. He's honestly a really smart guy, but I guess everybody has those things.
Yeah. That's odd. They're so
Yeah.
tiny wings.
I
That
thought
must
that
be
was pretty
tiny as
funny.
buffalo legs.
Yeah, so I thought that was pretty funny. Yeah, so did you have any retro experiences at the con this year? Did you meet any older creators or pick up any old comics or anything? I know you don't do a whole lot of shopping at the cons these days, but
I bought two archives. I bought a Doom Patrol Volume 3. I
nice.
bought a Black Hawk Volume 1. One of them, which I'm going to talk about today.
Nice.
Let's see. I got some old Superman and a lot of old Tarzan. And The rest of them, it was just commissions, and most of them were Valiant. I did get a retro version of Catwoman in her purple dress in a bondage scene done by Andrew
Oh,
Peepoy.
yeah.
So that's retro because she was in her purple dress.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Did you get your Tarzan comics from Rock's buddy Tarzan?
No.
Yeah.
Rock loves that guy, man. Like, that's his target. Like, it's like, go meet Daryl, Mike. No, Tarzan. That's his thing. He
I'm
gets
surprised.
excited. I was actually I found him for him, and I just followed him around. It's like, don't lose him, don't lose him. So I was like following a naked man around the convention center in Baltimore.
That's crazy. It's interesting how from one year to the next those consistencies,
Yeah,
like you have cosplayers that show up
he's
in the same
supposedly a
costume.
guy that spends a lot of money on old comics, but it's very unusual that he wears a lion cloth to the convention, and that's it.
Yeah.
He has some
Maybe he's
tennis shoes and a lion cloth, and that lion cloth is like, I mean, he's pretty much naked. I don't know. I don't know how they let him in.
I
There's
guess
female cosplayers that are questionable, but not that questionable.
maybe it's 'cause he is a guy. They're like
This guy spends a
more power
lot
to you.
here. Yeah, he's been there every year, that I remember.
Yeah, maybe he's just in addition to a comic book fan, he's an exhibitionist.
Yeah.
Just likes he likes to be naked around people. That's funny. And then yeah, there's just year to year there's those things that he's walking around naked and Chris Campbell's pointing at
Yeah, Chris Campbell's pointing at me.
you.
We went to the Valiant podcast, the panel. We went to the I went to the Dynamite one by myself. That was a good panel. That one had like a slew of like, it wasn't just like here's what's coming out and you know most of it anyway. It was more like a round table discussion with like Gail Simone, Mark Waid, Dwayne Swierczynski, all these Frank Terry, Bill Willingham. Oh, man, there was just so much. Garth Ennis, who I've never, ever, ever seen before. He's fascinating, man. He's like a historian of war, facts. He's amazing guy. John Cassaday, God, I'm trying to think of all of them. One of them's writing
Damn.
something of Charlie Woodward for Dynamite, which me and Daryl were talking to. God, I can't remember her name. She writes with Mark Waid and his digital imprint, and they're finally bringing her comic book to print at Dynamite. Christina Blanche, I believe her name is. So yeah, that was a fun panel, and it was interesting because they sat like Gale away from Willingham, and this is kind of retro because he said that Willingham says when he gets offered, like he's working on Legendary for Dynamite right now, which is like a steampunk pulp, all the pulp characters. I think it has like 10 pulp characters in it that are licensed. It's really good, but he says he won't like work on something that somebody else is working on because of Gale. When he was doing Batman in that one, he's famous for kind of like destroying Leslie Tompkins, like making her the reason that Stephanie Brown kind of got killed and everything. And just all that weird stuff, but he also blew up the clock tower. And he said that at that time, Gail was doing Birds of Prey, and she never f he got to break the news to her that he was going to blow up the clock tower, and she never kind of forgave him for that. But well, he actually remembers it more than she does. But yeah, whatever happened there was in a fun exchange, I guess. But it wasn't even his fault. It was the editors kind of saying, "Blow up the clock tower." But
Yeah,
it was a cool panel. Garth Ennis. I got to see Garth Ennis.
that's cool. It's interesting. It's almost a lot of names that you don't see a lot of times on panels and stuff. It's almost as if they were down with making an appearance for Dynamite.
Yeah, because
So,
they're all currently doing work
right,
for
but yeah, just but
Dynamite.
even like some that may not be interested in doing a DC or Marvel panel because it's a smaller company and stuff. They maybe were
Yeah.
down with making an appearance, or they just maybe that's a good sign for Dynamite as a publisher, and how they
Yeah.
treat creators or something.
Oh, Garth Ennis said that he kind of likes to do creator-owned stuff now. So, like, if you look at his work, well, he's known for Dynamite for the Boys, Jennifer Blood. He's kind of like licensed out somebody else to write Jennifer Blood because I read that. And then he's doing War Stories though, which is coming out from Avatar, which I'm really interested in, especially because I missed it when Dynamite published it, but. He's good. I really like him. I like what he has to say. He's very interesting. I would have liked to see him more, but I didn't see him like have a table. I only saw him at the panel.
Yeah.
The convention was huge. It was in a bigger building. It was a different part of the convention center. It was nice because it was connected to our building, our hotel, so we could just like walk across a walkway, and then we were there. But it was cool. It was a lot of fun. The most fun I had was at night with the dinners that we had and stuff. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. How was the walkways? Did they stay pretty clear? I know they've had that convention center's had some traffic flow problems with
No,
cons.
it was really wasn't bad. Saturday
That's
was
cool.
really busy, but everything else was pretty easy.
But people were flowing. They
Everybody,
were.
yeah, because they opened everything up. Like,
That's
you
good.
could get your badges on Thursday, so you didn't have to wait in a line to get them. But it was a cool convention. It was a little weird being in a different building, knowing that there was a different landscape. Like, I still missed a lot of stuff. It was like in a U-shaped layout, which it meant like most of. Baltimore is awesome though because it's almost all like creators and Artist Alley. Like their Artist Alley is huge. And in the middle is kind of like when you first enter in the U, it is kind of like they have the vendors with all kinds of comics and they have a lot of vendors there. I didn't even get to see half of them, it seems like, and I walked around. I spent most of my time in Artist Alley bruising and stuff, but it was a there was another part of Artist Alley on the other side, and I missed a lot of it because I didn't even know it existed. Usually there's like a really good separation, and this time it was like just all encompassing, like an Artist Alley is everywhere.
Gotta get used to the new layout, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool though. I mean, I've heard on different podcasts and stuff, whether it's Comic Con, or I know there's a few other big conventions that they have there. I know there's an anime con that I've heard people talking about, and times in the past, they've had some complaints about congestion in hallways and stuff like that, of trying to people getting crowded and stuff. So
Yeah,
that's probably something that they're working on.
it wasn't too much of a problem. Saturday, like in the mid-afternoon was probably where it was congested, but that's normal almost for any convention. Saturday is always the busiest.
Yeah, you're gonna have, if it's successful, you're gonna have a little bit of that. So that's cool.
How about your wedding? Is that good?
Was good. It was really good. I mean, especially we've had a little bit of a cold front come through the last couple of days, and yesterday was really chilly, so it worked out pretty good. We were able to have the ceremony outside. The weather cooperated for us, and there's just a lot of planning and stuff going into it, and you want everything to go smoothly, and for the most part, everything was pretty good. We're really happy with it. So, but yeah, leading up to it, It was an evening wedding, so I didn't really have shit to do Saturday during the day, you know. Kara was busy like getting ready and stuff, but I was just kind of a bundle of nervous energy just wandering around the house like trying to kill time.
Pacing.
Yeah, I was playing music on my phone and dancing with Luna and just being goofy and trying to distract myself. But once it was rolling, and especially after the ceremony and stuff, you could kind of relax and enjoy it. And yeah, we were both really happy with it. So
Very cool.
yeah, there's nothing nothing too retro about it, but except for our music, I would say. We had a lot of, I'd say the majority of our music, because we had a DJ and they had an online thing that you could access before the ceremony where you could put on songs that you definitely wanted them to play and songs that you play if you had the chance and that kind of thing. So like I said, we had that Depeche Mode song and we had a mix of 70s and 80s and stuff. One thing that was pretty cool and kind of retro was Kara found out about this group called the Vitamin String Quartet, and they've released tons and tons of albums, and it seems like their whole shtick is to do covers of popular songs, but in string version, like orchestral strings. And she found an album of that collected all the ones that they've done of prominent songs from whatchamacallit, Hughes movies. So we had that playing when the guests were arriving stuff. So there were songs from Pretty in Pink and things like that. That was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah. So, but yeah, we had a good time. Lots of dancing.
Orchestral maneuvers in the dark, and what is the other one? Psychedelic Furs. Those are the ones I
Yeah.
remember from that
Psychedelic
soundtrack.
Fairs.
They sing the Pretty in Pink song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty in Pink
And
and that.
OMD has the other song, but I can't remember what it is.
There's lots of good songs on those soundtracks.
We were listening to the Stand By Me soundtrack.
Oh yeah, that's right. I saw
And
that show.
well, what makes on cassette, yes. But what makes that one interesting is me and Barb were talking. That's probably the first movie we watched together before we were really dating. So, yeah, it was interesting. It was either that or Little Shop of Horrors, but we walked out on that movie. I'm not a fan of musicals.
That one's a kind of a funny musical,
Yeah, but I couldn't stomach it.
though. Stand By Me, now that soundtrack, that's an 80s movie, but it takes place mostly in the 50s, right?
Yeah, it's four kids, Corey Feldman, the guy that was in Sliders, I can't remember his name. He was in it. A lot of the famous kid actors were in it. The guy from Star Trek, the
Will Wheaton.
prodigy, Will Wheaton, was in it.
River Phoenix.
River Phoenix, yeah, he passed away.
Yeah, and Jerry O'Connell is the
Jerry
other one you're trying to
O'Connell, yeah,
think
the
of.
Sliders, yeah.
He was like a little chubby kid back
Yeah,
then.
he was chubby back then. They had to go find a. They basically were dealing with life, and they had to go. They found a dead body, and stuff like that. It's based on a Stephen King book. But it
Yeah,
was
it's
a great
actually.
soundtrack. I mean, it had a lot of oldies in there. Oldies but goodies.
Yeah, it's sometimes it seems like the best movies based on Stephen King stuff are the ones that are written off of like his shorter works, because that was actually based off of a novella, so it's maybe around 100 pages or so. It's kind of in between a short story and a novel, and that's the same thing with Shawshank Redemption. It's based on a novella of about the same length, but And it's a bit different, but I like both the story and the movie. I really love the movie.
Yeah.
Because even though it takes place in the 50s, it totally captures that feeling of when you're a kid and you're going on adventures.
Sure.
Like I
Times are
never.
much simpler and you're with your buddies and
Yeah, I mean I never had a dead body or anything that I was looking for.
yeah.
But I do remember like hanging out with my buddies and we would go out into the woods and look for
Porn.
Well, a lot of times we would, because that's the thing, like, and one of the things I think about the movie is like you have Kiefer Sutherland's in it too, and he plays one of the
Yeah.
older kids, and
They were the
one of
older
the
kids that
kids,
would pick on them, though.
right? Yeah, there was like him, and he was one of the younger kid's brothers, and then he had his older brothers or his older buddies. And I remember being a kid and having these high school kids in the neighborhood, and we were kind of frightened of them, and we would come across stuff that we found, like if we did come across like Playboys or something like that, it was usually the older kids that had left them out there, and we would find like tree houses and stuff like that that they had built, and we would go in there, but we were freaked out at any moment they were going to show up,
Yeah.
And in this movie, it's a kind of it totally captures that. It's just the stakes are a little higher because, these younger kids, they find out about this body, and the older kids actually have something to do with it. So they really truly are like that fear is real. They're actually after them.
Yeah.
But I remember we'd be out in the woods or the fields near my where I grew up, and we'd hear all of a sudden we hear the sound of an ATV, in the distance, and we'd think, and that meant the older kids were probably coming, so we'd freak out and start booking, like running for our lives. And this movie totally brings me back to that.
Yep, it's a good movie.
Yep.
That one in The Sandlot. I really like that movie.
Yeah, it's very retro.
Yes, very. I actually ordered the Batman 66 TV show.
Oh, the
Yeah.
new
The new release that's in
collection.
DCBS, yeah. It's an expensive thing, but I kind of want it, so.
From what I recall, it looks like it's a pretty nice, they put together a nice package, though, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They had like a couple options, and I did the Blu-ray previews exclusive option. So I look forward to digging into that in slow chunks.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. I don't have much nostalgia for that. I did see occasional episode on TV growing up, but for me, the 1989 Batman movie was the first time I ever really had any like excitement about the character.
Yeah. I loved it. But I saw it, I think, in middle school, and it was all on reruns. Yeah, it wasn't like played live or anything. I just,
Right, I
after
know. Yeah, you're
school,
not.
come home from school and turn on Batman.
Yeah, you're not quite that old.
It kind of was just like kind of like it was just to see who the villain of the month or the villain of the day was, you know? Because they had a cool list of actors playing these villains and stuff. All right. Do you want to dig into some comic books?
Sure.
You want
We
to
can
go
do
first?
that.
Because I think I went first last time.
Yeah, why not? I don't remember if it's true or not, but it all shakes out in the
Yeah.
end. So I've been curious for a while about various 70s Marvel stuff. Because it kind of sits in that gap for me of the 80s Marvel that Jim Shooter Marvel that I started reading as a kid, and then when I got back into comics as an adult and bought a bunch of Essentials volumes and saw the 60s Marvel and beginnings of the Marvel Universe and stuff. There's a lot of 70s stuff that I really have only heard about and stuff. And I was reminded of that recently when I came across an article on the internet about 70s Marvel and great series from that time. And so I checked out a couple number ones that fit in that category. First one, and I figure before I say what it is, I figure these kind of were sure bets for me. I went in with the expectation of liking them because I know I like this era, and I figured that it was a pretty good chance of these appealing to me. But especially in the case of this first one, which is the Tomb of Dracula number one, because these creators, Marv Wolfman, and of course, I'm drawing a blank now. What's the artist's name?
Gene
Gene
Colan.
Colan. Yeah. I just wanted you to say it with me. I like their stuff that they did later that's kind of in this similar spirit at DC, the Night Force stuff. I have read that and I know I like that. So, but yeah, this was,
Some of his best work, Colan's work, as far
this.
as like line detail, I don't know if you're reading it in black and white or color. You said essential, so maybe it is black and white.
No, I mean essential. So that was like I read 60s stuff and stuff, but this actually is on is digital. It's Marvel
Oh, okay.
Unlimited, so it's color.
It
But
works both it work the horror works really good. Like, sometimes you think, well, Green Lantern isn't going to be too good
yeah.
in like black and white, but like some of the horror, like the werewolf and the I Zombie and all that stuff, it works really, really well. Frankenstein's Monster, Werewolf by Night in black and white.
Yeah, I can see that.
Just like the war books do in DC, at least I think they do.
Yeah, I mean the color is put to effective use, but I can definitely see how it could work in black and white. There's a lot of monotone anyways for the night scenes. There's a lot of gray and black and blue. But there is a nice contrast created when occasionally there is a either a flashback or an interior in town near Dracula's castle. There's a bit of a contrast created by the brightness of those scenes. But yeah, this, in the 70s, Marvel started to bring back some of the horror books and stuff. And one thing that was interesting, even though I haven't read a lot of horror comics from this era, the 70s was an interesting time for horror. One of the things that I kept being reminded of reading this was the Shining, because the Shining is a classic subgenre in horror of it takes place in a hotel, but it's essentially like a haunted house story. And here we have a vampire story, and I guess you could also more naturally compare it to Stephen King's Salem Slot, which is also from the same time. But you have in the 70s in horror, you have kind of an emphasis on characterization. And that was one of the things I always heard about this series was that it was successful because they had a lot of characterization. They built a cast of characters that people got intrigued by, and I think that was one of the things that was kind of big in the 70s in horror in general, whether it's comics or movies or novels and stuff, was that you had these genres that were typical horror staples, but you had some strong characterization of the people that were involved in the horrific situations. And like in The Shining, you have this theme of Jack Torrance and his struggles with alcohol and anger as before they even get to the hotel, and then those things are exploited by the supernatural forces. Wolfman sets up characters that and introduces some issues that they have and flaws before there's even any supernatural elements. Because we got this guy named Frank Drake, and he is actually a descendant of Dracula. They've changed their last name for probably easily to understand reasons. And when we first meet them, he's heading into town in a rented Jeep with a woman named Jeannie, and excuse me, a woman named Jeannie and a buddy of his, and his buddy's name is lost it. I'll find it. I'll come back to it. But basically, they arrive in Transylvania, and the Castle Dracula has sat dormant for a super long time. It seems that they want to turn it into a tourist attraction. They have to, because their Jeep breaks down, they have to go into town, and they stop in this bar, and hardly anyone will take them up to the castle, and they're kind of like, this is all just superstition. What the hell's the problem? And the explanation is kind of like, no one, even the people that don't believe it, don't really want to take the chance anyways. And of course, it's a dark, stormy night. So his buddy Otto is his name. His buddy and Jeannie, they used to have a thing, so it's pretty like awkward situation. You have this like love triangle where Frank and Jeannie, they're together now, but she used to be with Otto. And about halfway through the story, we get a little bit of a flashback where we find out that Frank, he inherited a whole lot of money, millions, that his father, is basically his father worked real hard and built all this money up, and he inherited it and lost it in like a couple weeks. So he's got a huge burden of guilt because of that, and he builds a reputation for being bad with money, so he's none of his like country club friends or anything like that will give him a break. And then he's hanging out with Otto, and Otto finds out that Frank is a descendant of Dracula, and that he's got the rights to this castle. And Otto comes up with the idea to turn it into a tourist attraction. So it was Otto's idea, and even though it seems a bit suspicious, because at this point, Frank has stolen his girlfriend, and it seems strange that he's a little bit being so nice to him. So that's how they ended up here in Transylvania, and they go to the castle and everything like that. And there's some like jump scares with some bats that show up, but I was surprised at this point by how quickly the story moves along. It does have a 70s feel in that it's sort of dense with text, which is that's never really a problem for me, but unless it's just ridiculous. But I fully expected, by the way, that this was being set up, that that things would be a bit more drawn out with the appearance of Dracula himself, and some significant events for the trio. But at the same time, I kind of have to remember that, these were the days of newsstand comics, and they wanted to hook you. They were hoping that you'd pick up that one comic and be hooked by it to come back and, look for it at the newsstand next time. So, we know at this point that Otto he's got some ulterior motives. He does actually want Jeannie back, even though he's pretending he doesn't. So once they're in the castle and they kind of go their separate ways, he starts searching around, and he actually falls through a staircase and lands in a sub basement. And he's the first one to come across the Dracula's coffin. And he's actually really excited to find it, because it's for him, it's his confirmation that his whole idea is going to work, that he's going to be able to create this tourist attraction, that they've actually got something juicy to tempt people with. So he pulls the stake out of the skeleton, No, just not even believing for a second that there's any truth to it. So Dracula comes back to life, as a result behind his back, and he shoots at him, but with no effect, and Dracula throws him down into this trap door, and that's the last we see of him for now. But Dracula's pretty excited because he's a bit of a he's always been a bit of a lech. So he's excited that he hears voices in his castle again, and that one of them is a woman. So he's immediately interested in Jeannie. And the depiction of Dracula here is pretty classic. He has a lot of the same powers. He can turn into a bat, but he has the hypnotic effect, that he can draw people in with, and he uses it immediately on.
Look into my eyes.
Exactly. Whoa, that just gave me a little bit of a chill there, Mike. So yeah, he immediately uses that on Jeannie, but Frank has a silver compact that he uses to ward him off for a second, and then you can tell this is from the 70s because he cracks Jeannie across the chin to like knock her out of it and knock her out completely. So Dracula goes off and feeds on a barmaid from the village that was introduced earlier in the story, and it's kind of interesting how one of the villagers, when they find the body the next day, they basically pick up the body of the barmaid and parade through the city, with their body to as evidence that it's started again. And so a mob starts up, and as the word spreads that the issues probably from before have happened again, and they start kind of Frankenstein style, start gathering a mob that's heading for the castle, where Dracula he returns and he goes after a genie again while this is happening, and Frank and Dracula have a bit of a confrontation where Dracula finds out that Frank's actually his descendant, and he's like, "What the hell are you doing? You got my blood running in your veins. Someday the curse will visit you as well." Frank really obviously doesn't have much of a chance against Dracula, but that's when the mob arrives at the castle and starts setting the castle on fire. So the castle's burning. The last thing we see before that is Dracula hypnotizing Jeannie to take the crucifix off, and we see her throw it out the window. But Frank manages to escape the fire, and it's daytime. He finds Jeannie's body and thinks that she's dead, and he starts to grieve the loss of her. He's got his face covered with his hands, and he's weeping, and all of a sudden he hears, "Frankie, Frankie, don't cry. I'm not dead, you see. I'm not. When you're bitten by a vampire, you don't die. You never die. Never." And she gets to her feet and starts walking away with the bat flying over her head. So I was like, damn. Talk about a lot happening in one issue. I was throughout it. I mean, one of the things that kind of kept me going, as I read it, was the fact that all these things that were being set up, I thought, the resolution of them would be a lot longer coming. But,
It got moving fast.
it got moving fast. Even that barmaid, in the initial scene, she's set up as kind of like a, there's a guy named Fitz or something like that that's in the bar that's more of like a holy guy, like a or a religious person. He's not like a clergyman, he's just like a guy I think that's religious. But she's kind of teasing him. She's the like lascivious barmaid. I expected her to kind of be more of a character, but I forgot to mention when Dracula kills her, it's out of necessity, but he really wants Jeannie because there's that whole like morality to horror, just like in slasher flicks where the the vert like Jason will come out of the woods and hack to death people like kids right after they had premarital sex. There's a kind of like a touch of that here with like Dracula's, after he feeds on the barmaid, he comments on her blood being tasting not tasting that good because she's led a hard life, and he really wants, he really wants to feed on Jeannie because she's got the purity about her. But yeah, I was 100% satisfied with even with high expectations, I really got what I was looking for from this.
Very cool. I'm glad you covered some Marvel because I didn't. I'm still in my DC world. Okay, so my theme this week is ages. So I'm gonna go from Golden Age to Silver Age to Bronze Age. And
Nice.
start with a Golden Age Military Comics by Quality Comics 1941, which is the first appearance of Black Hawk. Created by Chuck Colder, Bob Powell, and Will Eisner. Although Will Eisner's kind of like the guy who's credited for it, he mentions the other two guys, and they're kind of all creators of the comic book. Black Hawk actually earned his own title in 1944. This was from 1941, and it was kind of his origin story, which is, I think I've read something very similar to this. I don't know if it was Enemy Ace or something very similar, but his origin is that it's 1939, and there is this this villain, Captain Von Timp. He's a Nazi pilot, plus he's like a leader. And Black Hawk and many of the planes, the Germans are attacking this area in Warsaw, and they're blowing the crap out of it. And the Americans show up with fighter planes, and one of them is Black Hawk. And Black Hawk's doing pretty good shooting down the Nazi planes and killing Nazis until this captain becomes involved, and that captain actually gets in his plane. He's usually behind the scenes as the leader, saying do this, do that, and that kind of thing. But he gets in his plane, shoots down Black Hawk near an area where his brother and sister are. So he sees his dying brother there, and he says, our sister's already dead. He tries to pull his brother out, but he passes on. And then you don't see Black Hawk for like a long time. And this Black Hawk, I don't even know if the character's name is different later on, but he's Janos Prohaska. And I don't think that's his name like when Chaykin takes over. But that's his origin story. But it's really cool because the Nazis capture this nurse and they're going to shoot her, and he comes to the rescue, of course, in his blue outfit. If you've ever read a Black Hawk comic book, you would see that blue outfit. And he takes out a bunch of Nazis and then rescues the girl. And he actually takes her to Black Hawk Island. So it's like right out of the bat, the first story, it tells you about Black Hawk Island. And it actually gives you a map of the island. So like
Nice.
if you're like in this, says here's the harbor, here's where the elevators are, the disappearing forts, the lighthouse, here's where the airport is.
I love when they give you maps.
Yeah, it gives you like a map and lays it out for you. And he actually captures that Captain Von Timp and takes him to Black Hawk Island and challenges him. It's kind of like a duel, but let's do a duel with airplanes. Well, while Black Hawk's not looking, he messes with the fuel gauge, so when he goes up to fight him, he's gonna be leaking fuel. And they get into this crazy fighting aerial battle where both of their planes crash, and Von Temp comes out, and then they end up doing a gun battle, like at the OK Corral. They pull out their pistols, blam 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 blam. They both are hit, but Von Temp dies, and then that nurse that he rescued actually nurses him back to health, and that's how it ends. But that was the first Black Hawk adventure. It didn't mention any of his other like Chop Chop and all the other guys. It was pretty much just him. But I only read the Black Hawk part of it because that's all that comes in the archive. But there was like other tales in there. It was probably a thicker, the Golden Age books were pretty meaty.
Yeah, they tended towards anthologies too. It seems like
Yeah.
it was rare for a character to have their have a book all to themselves. Even when you started having some characters that were title characters, they still seem to have backups or whatever.
Yeah, but it was a cool story. I liked it. I liked the artwork. So I think Eisner didn't draw this. I think he was credited for the character's creation, but I think it was that Charles guy that drew it.
Okay. Was there, did when you bought those, was there were there a lot of archive editions available,
Yeah,
or did you?
and if I had one of these conventions at my house, I would have bought a lot more because they were only $20 and it's a $50 book.
Yeah.
So
So do you know what kind of drew you to the ones that you chose, like in this case, Black
Black Hawk
Hawks?
because I haven't read it, and Doom Patrol because already had the other volume. I would have gotten
Gotcha.
more though. They didn't have any more. And so
I
yeah, that
lost you
was
for a couple seconds there.
okay.
You said they didn't have any more, and then it cut out.
Didn't have any more volumes of this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. That's what I figured you said, but I don't know if it came on the recording or not, so.
Yeah.
Sweet. Yeah, Blackhawks, that's an interesting property that DC, it sort of has an interesting history. The different times that it's popped up and that they've tried to do something with the concept. Even in the New 52. But all right, well, keeping with the era, I guess. The other 70s Marvel that I checked out. Oh, that reminds me, you were saying, thanks for picking some Marvel stuff. And one of the reasons that was fresh in my mind is I went to the store the other day and I had on a Thor t-shirt. And the dude that the clerk there and stuff commented on it and was talking about how he loves Thor, loves Marvel Comics, and Thor and Jean Grey are his favorite characters. And he was like quoting some Thor lines to me and stuff.
Where was this at?
I was at like it was at
At
just at the
Kohl's
store,
again in the bathroom?
not at Kohl's, no.
At the stalls? You were peeking in through a stall to see if it was available? I see your Thor shirt!
Right. No, it was at Target this time. Yeah, I'm trying to think if I haven't been back to Kohl's. I have a coupon though, so I might have to jump over there for some Kohl's action. Well, that sounded bad considering the stories I've told about Kohl's.
Yeah.
But anyways,
Lot of analysis went into that episode about like why people were shitting first thing in the morning.
yeah, that caught on people's imaginations. I think Rock has probably gotten he's a good authority on that kind of a subject, I've found, and he suggested that maybe they were employees that were just taking the opportunity to take a shit first thing in the day at work. I think he might be onto something there.
Well, he's a yeah, he put a lot of thought into that.
Yeah.
He specializes in poop.
Yeah. Yeah, he's willing to delve into dark areas that not everyone is willing to explore.
Yeah, quick shout out to Rock. He did get me a couple of Marvel Planet of the Apes comics, from the 70s.
Nice.
He got me a couple and brought them to me at the convention. That was pretty cool.
That is cool. Very nice. Yeah, so I just thought that was kind of funny that, it wasn't like, oh yeah, I saw the movies or something, but that he was talking about how he has these old school Fantastic Four pins that his that were his uncle's, that were the kind of pins where it was like paper with like plastic over top of it. So I was kind of wondering if maybe they were from one of the old school Marvel fan clubs or something, like Foom or something. But he said it was a Fantastic Four Silver Surfer fan too. So I thought that was pretty fun. But so none of those are related to what I read though, which I read Omega the Unknown,
Oh, wow.
Numero Uno.
I read that entire series. That is a really good series.
Yeah, again,
Very unusual, by the way.
exactly, yeah. I mean, again, like with Tomb of Dracula, kind of thought that this would be something that would appeal to me, from what I'd heard of it. So, that I went in with that expectation again, and this was written by Steve Gerber with Mary's, I don't know how you say her last name, but Skrenes or Screenes or Screens, but it was illustrated by Jim Mooney, with letters by John Costanza and colors by Petra Goldberg. It was actually edited by the author of my last book, Marv Wolfman. But yeah, Omega the Unknown, it starts out with Omega the superhero, a superhero looking guy in blue and red or black and red. And he's got the Omega symbol, which is it's just kind of an awesome costume. He doesn't have a mask or anything. He just has the Omega symbol across his forehead as like kind of like a weird headband kind of. But he's in sort of a post-apocalyptic kind of landscape, and he's fighting some foes with some futuristic looking technology and armor. He's just, the narration's telling us he's just trying to survive. And he lifts up his hands, and we see in the palms of his hands the Omega symbol appear, and he's able to shoot some energy blasts from his palms. And but at the end of the sequence, there's a one of these villains, look almost robotic, sneaks up behind him and blasts him with a gun, and it ends with him screaming. And then we flip over to a 12-year-old boy named James Michael, who wakes up in the middle of the night from a dream, screaming, his face in a similar expression to that of Omega the Unknown screaming. And his parents come in and to check on him, and we find out that they're actually in a motel on their way to a school that James doesn't want to go to, that he's been homeschooled up until this point, doesn't see why he has to make this change in his life. And his father says there's no discussion about it. You need imagination's fueled by experience, and experience is what you're trying to avoid. So that's the last word on the subject. On the next day, they get in their car, and James is still hasn't given in to the whole idea. And notably, his vocabulary is really advanced. He doesn't talk like a 12-year-old at all. And then there's this strange moment where he warns his mother that they're going to have a collision. Sure enough, coming around this mountain corner, their car collides with the front of a semi, and they go fly, the car's knocked off of the mountain. So it's a really, really bad accident. James is thrown from the car, and when he wakes up, he hears his mom's voice, and she says, "Come over here, James." And he crawls over, and his mom's actually, it's his mom's head, and we can see it at the base of her neck, some like metal and wires and screws and stuff like that, as if his parents were actually robots. And she warns him against the voices. Don't listen to the voices. It's dangerous to listen. And then it's almost as if his mom's head melts. So, the last thing he remembers is his vision is.
I think I lost you. Are you there? Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I lost
All
you
right.
again.
Where did you lose me?
When you were talking about the vision.
Okay. I mean, he has a little bit of a crazy vision where he's not quite seeing what's happening, but essentially the people are running towards him, responding to the flames and stuff from the crash. Which takes us back to Omega the Unknown, where he's been imprisoned by these creatures that he's fighting, but he's able to snap free once he's come to, and work on an escape. He makes it to a shuttle. The narration's talking about how it's more important that he survive so that he can come back and get revenge sometime, but until then, there's no point in looking back. So there's an overall kind of a vibe of this impending doom, his civilization being destroyed by these robots or creatures, whatever they are, and him managing to escape. So back with James. James wakes up in what seems like a hospital bed. He's got restraints, and there's a nurse there, and again, he speaks as if he's way more intelligent than a 12-year-old boy. The doctor that comes in to see him later remarks to the nurse, "You didn't tell me he was a 40-year-old midget." The way that he talks is very articulate and carefully composed sentences, kind of eerie. So James finds out that he's actually been in a coma for a month, even though he thinks that the car accident was just the day before or earlier that day. And they're kind of trying to figure him out. It's a psychiatric unit, and the doctor is really intrigued with him, but they don't have the funding to keep him there. The doctor wants to try to find some way to keep him around, but there's just not the money for it. So he tells the nurse, "Try to learn as much about him as you can before we have to let him go." The doctor goes to the board and tries to get them to commit the money to keep James Michael there, but they say the only way you're going to do it is if you put up the money yourself. So they come up with this plan, the doctor and the nurse do. Ruth, her name is. The doctor says, "You still got that roommate, right?" So next thing you know, that this woman named Amber comes into to James's room. He's playing chess by himself, and Amber pretends that she's looking for Ruth, but she's wearing just like a small top, like midriff bearing top, and so she sits down and says, I just can't play chess by myself anymore. I keep anticipating what the other me is going to do before I take my next turn. And she's like, I the voices get pretty loud sometimes, don't they? And he's like, the voices? Do you know about the voices? So she's totally playing him and pretending to be somebody that knows all about stuff that he can identify with. And Ruth finally shows up and says, "Oh, you're here, And Ruth, by this point, had trouble connecting with him, but Amber connects to him in just a few minutes, and because of that, he's willing to go along with this plan for them him to go live with the two of them. So later, he's laying in bed and wondering why he's so excited about the idea of living with Amber. Because he's still adjusting to being a 12-year-old boy, apparently. But here's where the two storylines converge: is that all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, one of these robotic-looking enemies that Omega was fighting comes crashing through the window of his hotel room, followed by Omega, and they fight it out in front of James Michael's hospital bed, and James has these strange sensations of feeling connected to this Omega. The moves that he's making, the pain that he feels when he gets hit by the enemy. There's some kind of strange connection that he has there that doesn't make logical sense. At a moment where Omega seems to be losing, James raises his hands in the same way that we saw Omega do earlier, and he's able to fire same energy blasts at the enemy and help Omega out. But
They explain that bond in future issues that you're talking about.
I assume that, yeah. But as of for this first issue, it's left us to be a mystery. And James says, "I've seen you in my dreams. Who are you, Omega?" And Omega doesn't say anything to him. He just picks up the enemy and walks out of the room with it without saying anything. And the doctor shows up at this point, having heard all the commotion, and the hotel room is just, or the hospital room is just completely destroyed. The bed's upended. There's a hole in the wall. The window's shattered. The door's not even all the way on the hinges anymore. It's like, holy shit, what the hell happened in here? But James falls to the ground because his hands feel like they're on fire. And when the doctor looks at them, he sees the sign of or the Omega sign on his palms, just like Omega the Unknown had. And I guess this was like every other month, because it says the next one's on sale in 60 days, and we'll have the Incredible Hulk in it.
Yeah, it's worth finishing. It has a very controversial ending in 10, and leads to another controversy that goes into Defenders number 76,
Oh,
where
okay.
it something happens into 10, and then it leads to something in Defenders number 76, where James Michael with the James Michael character.
Again, a lot of what I heard about it and expected from those expectations kind of were fulfilled. I definitely dug it. I like the weirdness of it, and that was one of the things I heard about it.
Very unusual series for Marvel to do, I thought.
Yeah, I think one of the things I wanted to try was because it seemed to kind of epitomize the that era of Marvel Comics is kind of unique to that time period where there was a bit of an anything goes kind of approach
Yeah, explore
that
this, explore that.
is sort of unique to that 70s mid-70s time period, the pre like post Stanley pre Jim Shooter era. And this kind of probably one of the better examples of their willingness to just try whatever ideas the writers that were there at the time came up with. So I
Yeah, for
enjoyed it.
those that like print, you can seek these out pretty much in a dollar bin.
Oh, really? Are they
Or you
expensive?
could go the trade route. There's a trade out there, which is kind of nice because it collects the 10 issues plus the Defender 76 and 77 I'm talking about.
That's good.
Yeah. Who Steve Gerber was big for in the Defenders, as well as Howard the Duck and Man-Thing.
Right.
He wrote
Yeah,
a
he
lot
was.
a bit about the how he felt about things in his books, about current politics and things that were going on.
Yeah, he's a very interesting figure. I've wanted to read more of his stuff, not just this, but the more I've read about him and his involvement with Marvel at that time, the more interested I've become in him as a creator. He's an interesting guy.
Yeah, and then if you go to his DC Focus line, I think it was Focus. They had done a lot of creator-owned things, and there was a prison one that they did. That was a really good title. It was the only one out of that line that actually had a sequel because it was a somewhat of a critical success.
Yeah, was that the other, was that his other collaboration with Mary S? So I
It
can't
might
say her
be.
last
I'll
name.
have to look it up real quick.
Yeah,
I can't
it's.
remember. I remember it begins. I think it begins with an H. Hard Time? That's what it is. It's
Yeah.
Hard Time, and then they made a Hard Time too. If you hear the door opening up, it's because Harley keeps on going in and out and in and out. I don't know why she's doing that.
I always assume that that's what that is. That's Harley. Yeah, we don't really.
Hard Time Season 2 and Hard Time. Let me see if she's co-collaborator on Hard Time. No, it was just him.
Oh.
Yeah.
My memory fails me again.
But it was good. I read that. It's basically a super powered boy who goes to like a prison. So that's an interesting story that was done in like 2000, I think it was 2004. I can't remember the line on it though. Let me see if I could zoom in on the cover. Oh yeah, it was DC Focus. It was,
I
yeah.
remember those coming out. I never read any of them, but I remember seeing them and wondering what the deal with them was. Because you could tell that they were like the branding. You could tell that that was a, even if you didn't see the DC Focus name, the graphic design of the different series told you that they were part of the same line.
Right.
The cover designs and stuff.
Well, my next book is Wonder Woman 182, and this
Cool.
is the era of Denny O'Neil and his I Ching, and she doesn't have any powers. This is where the Amazons retreated to another dimension, and she lost her powers, and she had the white jumpsuit, and in this case, she has a red jumpsuit, but. She's no it's known as the white jumpsuit era. This was a good comic. I'm a real big fan of Wonder Woman as it is. The artist is Mike Sikowski, and Dick Giordano does the inks. It features Tim Trench, who's been with the book, I guess, for a while, as a really strong Wonder Woman character, but he betrays I Ching and Wonder Woman, and actually Dr. Cyber, to steal something that Dr. Cyber had. And Dr. Cyber is pretty interesting because she's like a female, evil. How could I say? Like a criminal. She has a criminal organization network, and she's like in charge of everything. So, she doesn't have any powers except later on in. No powers in this issue, but in future issues, she gets like a body armor that enhances her strength, so she could go toe to toe with Wonder Woman, and it her armor does do energy absorption. But her first appearance is in 179, and this is 182. But it's really cool issue. So you open up with that Tim Trench betraying those three, and he takes off in a helicopter. He basically takes some of the jewel box that Cyber had, Dr. Cyber had with her. And then Diana Prince and I Chang essentially grab Dr. Cyber like they're going to arrest her. And I Chang is, I Ching, I call it Chang, but it's I Ching. He's blind. So he's like her mentor. And he's pretty badass. And he always has like great sayings. And he talks in a different way than all the other characters. But he talks in a manner that you could take like some of his speeches, and the sight of gold mutes the voice of many conscious to a whisper. You know, he talks really strange.
I
But
think that character's actually been kind of, in hindsight, a little bit embarrassing to Denny O'Neil.
yeah,
Because
probably.
as someone that's, he's always done a lot of like social justice stuff. In hindsight, I think he said like, yeah, that wasn't the best idea.
It's a product of its time. Just like a lot of these books have certain things that might be considered typecasting or in some aspects racial. There was one in Tarzan that was kind of like that.
Marvel had Masters of Kung Fu and it had a Fu Manchu in there.
Yeah. But he is a fascinating character. Like he's no joke. Like he's really mentoring Diana to be quite the fighter, even though she's powerless. So all of a sudden these snowmobiles come out of nowhere and they're part of her criminal organization. They're all females and they turn the tides on Diana Prince and I Ching. And then she brings out this falcon. It's very weird. And there's a lot of falcons and they all have the blindfolds on. And Dr. Cyber just says, if I remove these blindfolds, they're going to attack you and kill you. So all these birds attack Diana and I Ching. And Diana tries to fight him off. And I Ching looks like he's dead, but she does manage to kill the last falcon that took out I Ching. Because I Ching could fight, but he's blind. So he has to use all his other enhanced senses, kind of like Daredevil. But when he has thousands of flapping birds around him, it's kind of hard to orient himself, I guess. But she manages to take out the birds, and then this guy shows up in like this pretty badass car. Like, and they're overseas at the time. His name is Reginald Hyde White, and he's like a rich dude. And he's like, I'm not a medic, but I can take I Ching to a medical facility. And he's so rich that he basically takes him in this looks like a Fiari, and takes him to airport and gets in a personal plane and flies him to London. He's that rich. But they lead on that this guy is a double agent. He's actually working for Dr. Cyber. Like Diana doesn't know. And then you get into this really funny scene, which I thoroughly enjoyed, where he's so rich, he's like, let me go buy you some dresses, Diana. He just goes, and then you have like about 12 panels of her trying on all these different outfits, like mini skirts that are like right at the crotch level, and all these psychedelic outfits. And he's like, "Oh, you look fantastic. You look like something out of a fairy tale." And she's like getting into this, and she's like, "Man, this guy's rich. I start liking to be in high society. I feel like I'm in a Cary Grant picture." So she's really falling for this guy, which it's really bizarre. And I Ching basically goes to Won Lo, who's a guy that he knows in London, and he wants to try to trace down where Dr. Cyber may be. And Won Lo brings his assistant brings tea to them, and it's like ticking weird sounds. And I Ching, because of his enhanced hearing and smelling and stuff, he's like, "That shouldn't be in the teapot. You know, something's weird here." And Won Lo says, "My Ling, what is this? Some girlish prank? The new generation, old friend. No respect." And he goes, "Wait, that's not My Ling." So he didn't even know it was a different girl. But it was a bomb in that pot, and they were gonna blow him up. And unfortunately, Won Lo actually died, and so did the girl that brought the pot. And she had mentioned that it was Dr. Cyber's doing. So he managed to get away, and he goes out to Big Ben essentially, and waits for Diana and this guy to drive up. And they take their sweet time, and he basically tells Diana, "I love you." He says, "All my life I've waited for someone of your sensitivity and beauty. Blast it, what am I trying to say is I love you. I want you." And she's like, "Reggie, please. More than anything in the world, I want to marry you. In the few hours since we met, you've become everything to me. I need you, Diana. Give up this foolish chase you're on. Come with me." And she's like thinking to herself, "Oh my God, what is happening to me?" And they're making out right in front of I Ching. He doesn't even know that they're like he's waiting for him. And they decide to team up and then go try to track down I Ching. And then you get a commercial break, and I love these commercial breaks. And the Wonder Woman comics are fantastic because I think they're catering to the female, and it's like marriage a la mode. It tells you how to get married in different cultures. So like in they show a Muslim wedding where the bride and groom are seated facing a mirror on the floor. In the front of the mirror are silver compote of sweets, and they just essentially those sweets are supposed to represent happiness. And then it says, in the Dayak native of Borneo, he chooses the girl he'd like to make his wife. He initiates his courtship by carrying a load of wood for her. Was like, that's very unusual. And then they go to Japan, and it says this bride to have her eyebrows shaved off to symbolize her subservience to her husband and identify her as a married woman. And then in
Crazy.
Somaliland, basically the guys on Mombasa Island wrestle, and whoever wins the wrestling match can get the woman, will get to wed the girl. But this is just fantastic shit, man. That's what I love about Wonder Woman. It's just bizarre. So they end up going to this party in this real rich estate because they overheard these other two women talking about that. And this other woman works for her name is Lady Rothwell, and she actually works for Dr. Cyber. So she pulls a gun on them and tries to hold them hostage, puts them into a container where Wonder Woman has like these cool jewelry gadgets that she got from an Irish weapon maker in Wonder Woman 181, and she's able to use this bracelet to form a grappling hook and grab the keys and get them out of there. And so they escape. At this time, she still doesn't know that Reginald is a double agent. They actually go to a fountain where they're supposed to try to track down some riddles, and they're attacked by Dr. Cyber's women. And Diana manages to thwart them, and then they take off to another location. And then a lot of females attack again, and this time they knock out Diana and bring her to Dr. Cyber. I really like this Dr. Cyber character. She's really, really interesting. I wanna learn more about her. I knew more about her, but in the current incarnation where she had the armor, here I think she's much more interesting. It's like a kingpin in a crime syndicate overseas. But they capture him, and they manage to get away, and he reveals himself to be a double agent, but he can't shoot Diana, so Dr. Cyber thinks that of as a betrayal. And then she he has the guns pointed on Diana and I Ching, and he says, "Diana, don't look at me that way." She's starting to cry, and he says, "Please forgive me." He says, "You," she says, "you lied to me. You said you loved me. I believed you, and you were using me, only using me. I believed you." And she beats the shit out of him. I Ching has to say, "Diana, stop. Those blows can cripple." And Diana says, "I want to hurt him. I want him to feel what I'm feeling." This is great.
Jeez.
And then there's a thing in the last little bubble there that says, "And far away, another tormented soul cries out in her agony," and it shows Thermascara on that other island. And they said, "Tell Diana she must return to Paradise Island. Tell her mother needs her." So that's how it ends. And then it's got some interesting letters, pages from a woman from Des Moines, Iowa, that talks about her. I love these letters because it shows you what it was like back then to complain about stuff. Like she was complaining, Wonder Woman was losing her powers. She didn't give a shit. She doesn't want to read it. But then she read it and she really loved it. Said it established her as a better character. But and then you get some more wedding forecasts, like things to predict weddings, like to bake pies and Saint Catherine's Day, and it's tradition in Germany on Saint Andrew's Day for a group of unmarried people to float individual cups in a vessel of water. When two cups hit each other, it indicated that their owners would marry. I'm like, what the fuck is this shit? It's just bizarre stuff. But
I should have read this comic a couple weeks ago.
you should have. You could have taken some of this knowledge and brought it to your wedding.
Exactly. That's
These
so
Wonder
weird.
Woman comics are fantastic.
Wonder Woman comics, like the whole history of them is just like you could do so much analysis on them
Yeah.
from the very start of why, the intentions of William Marston and creating her and or
Yeah, the
not the
bondage and all that
and
weird
all
shit.
that
The
and
lie detector, everything. She's fascinating. I love Wonder Woman.
but
She's my favorite female comic book character, next to Big Barda. But Big Barda doesn't nearly have the amount of work that Wonder Woman has. You know what I mean? She's always
it's not the
had a
same
book
amount of
out.
history,
Yeah, Big
but yeah,
Barda's kind
it's
of like a side character that I just love when she shows up.
Yeah, it's almost as if there's just so much history there and so many different approaches and reflections of sort of views on women at the time,
Yeah.
and yeah, I didn't quite realize that because when you first were just describing the romantic scenes, it's like that does not sound like Wonder Woman,
That doesn't at all. And this dude's basically said, "I've only known you for a couple of hours, but I want you to marry me."
Right.
It's hilarious.
But then when you're explaining the intervals with the wedding traditions and stuff, it becomes a bit more clear that that's the audience that DC was trying to go for with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's pretty fascinating.
This is a weird one. It says, according to an old Scotch superstition, a boy and a girl could determine their chance of marriage by placing a couple of peas from a pod on a glowing piece of coal. If the two peas burned on the coal, the duo would marry. If any of the peas fell off the coal, they would never wed. This one's crazy as hell too. To discover a future mate, a girl would place her initials on a cake she baked between 11 p.m. and 11 p.m. and 12 p.m. on Halloween Eve. It was fancied that at the strike of midnight, she'd have a vision of her husband to be.
Weird.
You put the initials on a pie, and at midnight on Halloween, you'll have a vision of the face of the guy you're gonna marry. What the fuck
Things have changed, I guess.
We can talk about this all day.
Yeah, I thought. I guess your idea to charge money to dance with the bride and groom wasn't too off the wall.
It's not.
Yeah.
You should have done
Actually.
it. Barb, he never heard of that thing where you actually go to a wedding and you have to pay a buck or whatever to dance. What do they call it? Dollar dances? Yeah, I never heard of that.
Kara,
I
I
told
told
him to
Kara
do
about
it.
it though.
I
I told
told him
Kara
to
about
do
it.
it.
She said Kara said she's been to weddings where they did
Yeah, she seems more knowledgeable. Like you never been, except
that.
you never knew about abracadabra. Come on. Did you not even know about it? Like until I put the song in the, even when I put the song on the episode, did you hear it?
I did hear it. I liked it, but I
You
really don't
never
think
heard
I
it?
ever heard it. Yeah, I don't know how I missed it. Cause I tend to I seem to know most of the other songs from that time period, but I don't come across too many songs of that style of music from that time period that I haven't heard before. But yeah, I did have it stuck in my head though, especially after I watched the video of you and Alan doing it.
That was fun.
Because then, I mean,
Alan li Alan likes to sing, so it's fun
yeah,
to sing with
he was
Alan.
down with it. I'm sure he wasn't. I didn't think he was tough to get to recruit for that. But yeah, here I just, heard tons of good music that I picked out the night before, and I watched the night after the wedding. I watched those videos. And of all the songs that have stuck in my head the next day, I'm walking around. I want to reach
Reach
out and
out and
grab
grab you.
it. So I definitely know the song now. You guys made sure of
Every time I call your name, I heat
that.
up like a burning flame. Burning flame, full of desire. Kiss me, baby, let the fire get higher. Just love that shit.
Is a cool song. I do like it. Oh, I one funny thing that happened that I didn't mention was that I think we had a wedding crasher.
Somebody just showed up.
Yeah, but like the worst wedding crasher in history, because they, I don't know, it's almost as if they were just wandering through the neighborhood and just happened to and just decided to waltz in or something. Not literally waltz, though that would been appropriate for a wedding. Yeah, they just like wander in or something, because I'm looking, I see this dude.
During the reception or the.
No, it was like later on during like after dinner, it was like
Okay.
during the dancing. I just saw this dude standing off to the side in jeans and sneakers. Like, and he's just kind of like looking up at the ceiling and just kind of checking things out, smiling. And then he walked away, and then I saw him come back, and he had a glass of wine. And I was just like, what the,
Maybe
and
he was a listener of Retrocast.
maybe, yeah. But he seemed like he was high or something, so I thought maybe he's just wandering, through the neighborhood. He's like, oh, what's going on in here? Because there was a security guard, but there was a couple, maybe I think maybe he came in through like a door that was open for the caterer or something. I don't know. That's just my speculation. But and then I was gonna see if I should do something about it, but then I saw the security guard and like the two people, like the two event planners that worked there. All of a sudden, they were moving around and like communicating with each other, and so I figured they were on top of it. So yeah, I mean, we
Your
didn't have any.
Batman skills were no longer needed.
Exactly, yes. My senses were dulled by that point. Although, I don't know, I think all the beer I drank was all just perspired rapidly
Was
from dancing.
it close to midnight and somebody cooked a pie And you were having visions of some guy smoking weed, drinking wine.
No, I don't know what you're talking about. Was that, is that that's from a song, isn't it? This another thing I'm gonna have to ask Kara about, Mike,
Yeah,
about.
you might have to.
It sounds like that sounds familiar at least. I don't know. But yeah, so that was kind of funny. It wouldn't have been funny if we had some presents go missing or something, but
Yeah.
since that didn't happen, it was just amusing.
If you had the dance for a dollar thing and all the dollars were gone.
Yeah. Or maybe he would have paid Dance with Kara. Maybe
Yeah.
that's what he was looking for.
Maybe.
He's like, oh, this is a wedding. I wonder if I can dance with the bride. I got a dollar. All right. So I'll do my last comic real quick. Which this is not a 70s Marvel, but it is a Marvel. It's the second, or it's the next issue in line after the Daredevil issue that I covered a couple of weeks ago, 235. This is 236, and I just thought it was going to be interesting to talk about this because I read it and just wanted to read the next issue, and but I thought I'd talk about it because this, whereas the last issue, if anyone was listening, that was sort of a transition issue between the Frank Miller era and when Ann Nocenti started writing the book for a long time. And it was just a kind of a fill-in story. So this is 236 is written by Ann Nocenti, and it's very just totally different feel, tone, everything from the previous issue. It's got Barry Windsor Smith art. So it's really cool looking. And it's an interesting story. You know, I've seen a lot of people kind of laughing or poking fun at the writing that Ann Nocenti's done for DC recently with Catwoman and
I think I'm the only one that likes it.
yeah, I mean, I think
But she's done a really good job with Katana. I mean,
yeah, I mean.
Catwoman's a little bizarre. It's really stylized type of writing that reads really weird. But you know what I appreciated about it is it was really different. It was really it was about an underground gangster war. It was bizarre.
That does seem to be the main criticism people have of it, is that it's really bizarre and they're having trouble following the story
It was like Omega the Unknown. Where did
and
this come from?
yeah. So I mean, I can't speak personally. I haven't read them, but I hear a lot of people criticizing it, and even in some unkind ways, they're just kind of making fun of it. But her style, you know, her Daredevil runs seems to be well thought of, if like more of not as well known, but not talked about a lot. But people seem to like if they do talk about it. And I definitely didn't find this confusing, but it is sort of a unique plot and everything. It starts out with this scientist who is talking about the human brain and how to control the human brain in a psychological way. And it turns out that he's making a presentation to the Black Widow. They actually make a reference to Nuke, the super soldier that that's appeared in Captain America a number of times, and there was recently a story with him.
He just showed up in Death of Wolverine. I don't know if you're reading that, but
No, did he? Oh, okay.
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know that like a year ago or something like that, he was in Captain America again.
Yeah. Yeah, Rick Remender's cap. Yeah.
Yeah. And but he seems to have been a recent story. And they're talking about in reference to this guy, Agent Hazard. It's sort of another situation with the experimentation with soldiers and having difficulty controlling them and stuff. So they're sort of prepping Black Widow to track this guy down, and Natasha is working with this doctor because she has to, but she's like, he's like super, like mad scientist kind of creepy dude she has no interest in. It's totally out of necessity, like she has no respect for him. And she's also getting, when she leaves the meeting, she gets, there's all these like brawny dudes that are standing around, boys club kind of thing. They're giving her shit for having a code name and being a former spy and how they don't trust her. And there's a lot of like chauvinistic stuff where like I hear Hazard's a real heartbreaker. I bet she won't have the guts to kill him. She'll probably just fall in love with him. We catch up with Hazard. He's like in an apartment in the city, and this woman's hitting on him, but he seems to, we definitely get the impression that he's having issues. He's sweating, and he's reading an article about Nuke. There was actually a storyline, I think it was actually towards the end of when Mazzucchelli and Miller were doing on the book that dealt with Nuke. So I remember some of the Mazzucchelli covers. They were really like good covers with Daredevil and like the American flag and stuff. So Hazard, true to his name, is a real real like loose cannon here. And he has this ability where he projects this field that interferes with technology. I don't know if it's technology in general, but like people who have pacemakers and stuff like that are at risk around him. And there's an incident that happens outside of this building on the street, and this guy starts, it's like near the 4th of July, or it actually is 4th of July, and this guy's got a package of fireworks, and they start going off because of his proximity, because of Hazard proximity. And then he starts clutching at his heart, wondering what's going on. So Daredevil's actually nearby at this point. This is where he gets pulled into this, and with his, there's definitely a like last issue, because this is a new creative team. There's some introductory sort of captions and stuff that gives you, it's handled pretty nicely. It's economic, while there's action going on in the panel, that advances the story going on. There's some captions that give you a little bit of essential information on the character if you're just picking this up and don't really know much about Daredevil. But by the time he gets to the scene, this guy has passed away, and here he runs into the Black Widow, and they have definitely a history. By this point, there had been, for a little while, the book was Daredevil and Black Widow, back prior to Frank Miller and stuff. So they have a history. They go back and do a little bit of catching up. They talk about the Nuke incident, and Black Widow talks about she's kind of like a freelancer right now. And just a little bit of just like nice continuity that Nocenti throws in here for people that have been reading the book for a while, because Natasha refers to some of the stuff that's been going on for Matt. there's just references in passing, like she might say, to stuff that happened during Frank Miller's run. It's kind of like, glad to see you're bouncing back from all the shit that you went through, kind of thing. Almost kind of, kind of reminds me of when Mark Waid took over Daredevil a couple years ago. The tone of this, like, it's still Daredevil. It still doesn't feel like, say, like Spider-Man or something that you're reading, but it seems like it's lightened up a bit since all the stuff that went on in the Frank Miller era. But he doesn't have much of a life outside of his costume, but he's trying to regain that. And there's a little bit of just discussion as to how he's keeping that balance and stuff. So Daredevil ends up giving Natasha a hand. And in the meantime, Hazard goes to visit his mother. And it's an interesting scene psychologically. His mother seems to be really proud of him and think of him as like a good soldier. And she wants him to meet her nephew, this little boy Tommy. And he's telling Tommy how Hazard's a hero, and Tommy wants to be a big he wants to be a big hero too, and wants to be a soldier, just like Hazard. And Hazard's just like not in the mental state to deal with this kind of stuff. And but then he gets freaked out because his mom has like a almost collapses and has a strange like heart murmur. He's wondering if it's because of him, but this kid Tommy, he wants to learn how to be a soldier, and he comes in to the room. He's got like a toy gun and a helmet on and stuff. So he's like, "You really want to learn how to be a soldier? Here, hold on to this." And he gives him a real gun, and he's the kid's like surprised at how heavy it was. And Hazard's like in a really weird place at this point. So that's a monster you got in your hands. Pull that trigger once and you're dead. Your whole life changes. Never be the same again. Point that thing at me and don't let me out of your sight, and be ready to shoot. But so as Natasha and Daredevil, as the two of them are heading towards the scene, Natasha's filling him in on some of the background here and how it was like a project called Project Heart Attack, and Hazard can explode a man's heart at will. Meanwhile, it's like all this, there's fireworks constantly going off in the background in the sky, because it's 4th of July. And finally they arrive at this odd scene with Hazard standing there with this little boy holding a gun, and him and Daredevil get in a fight. And Natasha gets the boy out of the way and comes and joins in. But it comes to sort of a sad ending, where Hazard keeps seeing the doctor from the beginning of the issue, instead of other people. He thinks that Natasha is the doctor, and it's happened to him other times throughout the issue, where Hazard just wants to live the American dream. And there's just a lot of subtext about the use of soldiers. And I won't explicitly state the ending, but it's a sort of a sad, depressing ending. And then sort of the kicker to it all is, we see the little boy, the nephew that was there earlier. He's back in his bedroom looking out the window at the ash falling from the sky from the fireworks and stuff, and he's pretending to shoot the gun that he has. So there's a lot of, I mean, there's a lot going on in the issue as far as commentary on, war and the usage of soldiers and how Hazard is, kind of similar to the character Nuke, but a different spin on it. How Hazard is this. He has a lot of dialogue throughout the issue, that reveals his psyche and, the dreams that he had, and I was just kind of bought into the whole American, apple pie, blonde haired girlfriend, all that kind of stuff, and how he was used, and sort of destroyed by the experience. It's kind of a superhero take on the like the veteran destroyed by their experiences in war, even though they survived it. So it's a pretty heavy topically, but I think, I mean, that's one of the things I've heard about Nocenti's run on the book, is that, and her writing in general from that time period, is that she brought a lot of social commentary into things. That was pretty good.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like a one, she does one issue, right?
Yeah, that was just one issue.
And then she comes back later and does the series, or don't think she does it sequentially. Like, this is 236.
Okay, yeah.
And
Now
then,
that you say that, that does jog my memory a bit.
Steve Englehart does the next one. Okay, now that. She's away from one issue, and then all of a sudden she's back, and then she's writing full time.
That's right, yeah.
She gets a few breaks in there, but that's probably
Yeah, that's the funny thing
like
was,
246 is written by James Ollsley, who's also known as Christopher Priest.
Oh,
But
right, yeah.
yeah, she has quite a run on there.
Yeah, she wrote it for, she's, I think, one of the longest running Daredevil writers ever. The funny thing was that I talked about 235 a couple weeks ago, and that, and then 237, the issue after this one that you were just talking about that has Claw on the cover. Both of those were among my very first comics that I got. And they were random packs, so for whatever reason I didn't have 236, so this was my first time reading it. And
It does have that border that you
but it
like
has
so
that border,
much.
yeah, which I did have a lot of, because I so it's from that time period, so I had a lot of the issues that had the portrait with the character border, the 25th anniversary covers, but Daredevil wasn't one of the ones I had, so.
There goes Harley again.
Oh,
It's going.
Harley.
It's a nice day. Just stay out there.
Yeah.
Well, I got two more books, but I'm gonna cover them really quick.
That's fine.
They're both jungle stuff. So I got Tarzan of the Apes number 210, which is the fourth DC issue. I guess they just kept the numbering of the previous incarnation. Whatever company had it by before that. And what's amazing is if you look up Tarzan in the database, man, there Tarzan's been. It's been at Marvel, it's been at DC, it's been almost everywhere. Lately, he's kind of been at Dynamite, but they call him Lord of the Jungle. They call him Tarzan within the book, but I guess they don't have full rights to use the word Tarzan. So this is done by Joe Kubert, and the credits are pretty much him. It's him writing it based on Edgar Rice Burroughs, so he's credited as the writer as well, but it's all Joe Kubert. And this, let's see what I got on this. It's from 1972. It's pretty much where Tarzan, it talks about the origin of Tarzan, where Tarzan rescues Jane Porter and from this ape called Tarkaz. And it talks also about William Clayton. He's the guy that came with Jane Porter. And has this jealousy against Tarzan, and then it features this Lieutenant Durnot, who's a French lieutenant, who actually comes to help William Clayton when they're stranded there, and It's a pretty straightforward story. It t talks about the rescue, Tarzan rescuing Jane, them becoming in love, and then he goes off, and this lieutenant is captured by the Mbongu tribe, and it does mention that this tribe has been screwed over so many times by the white man that they just don't like the white man. They pretty put that lieutenant there at a stake, and they're gonna pretty much kill him. Maybe cook him, maybe burn him. But Tarzan comes, and Tarzan never shows himself to this tribe. He's very mysterious because he goes in and gets the job done, and they think of him as like a god that takes what he wants when he wants it. So he actually rescues that lieutenant. Jane Porter is rescued by, well, she's not really rescued. She's not in danger, but she's discovered by William Clayton, and he takes her and says, "Let's go back to where we were from." And he essentially takes her, and he hates Tarzan. He's showing his jealousy there, but then he remembers how Tarzan had saved him from a lion previously. So he's got like this love-hate thing for Tarzan. He knows that Tarzan's legit, but he has this jealousy thing, especially for Jane. He loves Jane. And he's got like this mischievous run in him. But as he rescued that lieutenant, that French lieutenant taught him to speak French. He learned French real fluently. He already knew how to read English. It doesn't have a lot of apes in here. This is like the period where he decides he needs to go back and find Jane. So he's like leaving the jungle on this long trek. He goes back. He gets actually shot. When he finds out that Jane's gone, he leaves after Jane to try to catch her before she leaves. And that French lieutenant, when he comes back, that French lieutenant's like, "What am I gonna do here? I'm not gonna be able to get out of the jungle without Tarzan." But he's like got this paranoia thing going on, like, "What am I gonna do?" But Tarzan comes back to the hut saying, "I couldn't leave you here," and that lieutenant shoots him, like
Jeez.
grazes his head, so he's bleeding, but it's not terminal. So they go on this trek back to try to find Jane. They eventually get there. He finds on his journey, he finds out that he's really Lord Greystoke. But this is the part I don't understand, because they didn't know about him, that William Po Clayton guy actually says he's now Lord Greystoke. So he must have been like the second cousin of, and because everybody's dead, he becomes the lord of the manor. And Tarzan says no, he has the evidence that he's Lord Greystoke, that his parents were killed, and he could show it to him, but he's hesitant to show her, and that's kind of how it ends. So you don't know what's gonna happen, other than he's over there in England, and you don't know if he's gonna do anything about it. But that's how that book ends. And then the other one I just gonna talk about briefly is Rima the Jungle Girl number 2. I had talked about number 1. And this story is really cool. I like this one more than Tarzan, because I Tarzan one, you kind of already know what the story is. You're just enjoying the artwork and some of the subtleties that you didn't know, because everybody's kind of read Tarzan and knows what it is. And it's so far going by the book. Whereas Rima, I don't know anything about her, but the Rima, if you remember, had that mercenary guy Abel, who was picked up by that tribe, and that tribe in number 1 said, "Don't go into that jungle area, it's haunted, and nobody ever comes out." Well, Abel went there, and he found Rima. He actually saved Rima, or he thinks he saved Rima, but actually got bit by a snake in issue 1, and they kind of nursed him to health. Old Nuflo, who's Remo's grandfather, nursed him back to health, and he was there. So Rima actually says how she could talk to the animals, and she's real nature friendly, and she just grew up with animals, and she has like this communication with them, even though she's not like powered like Aquaman or anything. She seems to be able to communicate with them, and they're not a threat to her. Like there's a jaguar that comes, and she's like, "No, don't worry about it." And she pets the jaguar, and it goes away, even though he thinks it's gonna attack him. And then they get this is what's really interesting about this book that kind of makes me chuckle a little bit. You know, on the podcast and on Facebook, we chuckle a lot about vegetarians and eating meat, and because you don't eat meat. And Keith is kind of like does the veggie thing because of Michelle, and me and Daryl are like pro meat.
Yeah, and then you got and Bill on Geek Brunch, regular Geek Brunch.
Yeah, Bill won't eat meat. He'll eat fish, but he doesn't eat meat. But what's funny about this is you see old the grandfather, who they called Old Nuflo. He goes with his two dogs. He has two dogs, and he goes out in the middle of the jungle, and Abel follows them. He's like, "What? You know, is there something mischievous going on?" And he's like going deep into the forest, and he lights a fire and he starts cooking some meat. And he's like, "What the fuck? You know, do you not want to share the meat with the rest of us or what? You know, what's going on?" And he's known Rima will get really upset if I eat meat. So he like leaves the hut and goes like miles so he can have a piece of meat. And so Abel and him sit around the fire and they eat all this meat. Which they killed some animal and they ate it and it was delicious. Then they're like real satisfied and they go back to the hut. And Rima's like, she could smell
She
that.
smells it on
She smells meat. Gets
him.
pissed off at this Abel guy. Like she's like real hatred toward him. And he gets upset and he leaves the hut, goes back to that tribe that found him, and he tells that tribe, you know, it's not haunted over there and all that, but they don't believe him. They said, "You're the only one that came back." Hello?
Hey.
Hey, let me see if it started again, the recorder. But anyway, he leaves, goes back to the tribe, and decides to go back to Rima. She forgives him. And then Rima all of a sudden says, "I need to go leave this place. I need to go explore." And that's kind of how it ends. And then there's that sci-fi Voyages. Backup by Alex Nino and Robert Kaniger. And Robert Kaniger was the writer of Rima the Jungle Girl with art with Nestor Rondonda and Joe Kubert. And that was from 1974. But the Space Voyages one was really confusing because I remember the astronauts in number one, they land on this planet and they find bodies of themselves. And then all of a sudden, this one starts off, and there's like this huge brain that's trying to manipulate them. Like it's got an eyeball in the brain, and it's trying to attack them. But they actually defeat it with the spirit of humanity. What makes humanity unique? It was a pretty bizarre story, and didn't flow well from what I read in the first. But it was artistically pretty cool. But yeah, that's all I had.
Okay. Nice.
Don't eat meat around Rima.
Yeah, she'll smell it on you.
She'll smell it on you. They had that like eight panels just to describe them, like him like walking through the woods and like building up suspense. Like, what's he doing? Is he like mischievous? No, he's just starting a fire so he can cook some meat. I thought that was great.
That's funny. That'd be funny if that's like if I tried to start eating meat again and I had to
Yeah.
do that. I go like
Go build a fire in your backyard, real like in the middle of the night.
go down to like somebody else's backyard, a couple of doors down. Like, what are they doing out there with that?
Could
Somebody must
smell
have
it
a
on
fire
you.
in
What did you
the
do?
neighborhood. That would be funny.
You have any other ones?
Nope, that was all mine, those three.
All righty.
So we can hit some Buck Rogers.
I tried to get to a Marvel, but I was in the mode for this jungle stuff.
Yeah.
I almost read the Cap one, which continued the previous story I was reading. the Bloodstone arc, but decided to stay
Yeah.
in the jungle.
That's
I'm
one
glad I
genre I
did.
haven't read much of, is those jungle ones.
Yeah. Well,
Yeah, I
I had
mean.
gotten a I did a Kickstarter called Primal, the Jungle Warrior,
Oh, I
and
saw you
I
post a
was
picture of that.
really happy with that book. Like I was like, and it kind of got me in the mood for reading some jungle stuff. So, got
Yeah, I was gonna say
did some
sometimes.
Tarzan and Rima. Rima, I
Nice.
liked a little bit different because it just it hasn't gone anywhere, but I actually like that it hasn't. It's basically this mercenary discovering Rima, and now after two issues, Rima decides she needs to leave there, and it talks about her uncle, and it's got such a weird cover. It has Rima's grandfather there with the two dogs, except they look vicious, and it looks like they're gonna attack Abel. And that's like nothing in the stories like that.
That sounds so bizarre.
Yeah, I was highly entertained. Not as entertained. I mean, if I had to rate the books, the Wonder Woman 182 was so damn enjoyable from so many different aspects. Even the art. And then probably Rima was my second favorite, and then Military, and then Tarzan.
Yeah, sometimes it's different if you have to be objective
Yeah.
about it, but you can
All
look past
enjoyable,
certain
but
things.
yeah.
Nice. So should we wrap up with our Buck Rogers episode then?
Yeah, this one was highly enjoyable. Barb and I enjoyed it a lot.
The Olympiad. They still have the Olympics in the year 2492, apparently. Although they're not quite what they used to be.
Yeah.
And they're held on the planet Mykos. It's not just the countries of Earth anymore. It's Earth representing itself amongst other planets. It's an interplanetary Olympics at this point. And they have a lot of new weird sports that Buck doesn't recognize. And instead of a big audience, they just there's no audience. It's just transmitted, and but so that the athletes still feel cheered on, they have they pipe in canned applause and stuff like that.
It's so weird. And one thing I really liked about it, though, is when they were going to the main area of, like, they had that one track that went in, like, an S format and it just ended.
Yeah. I
One
like the
thing.
two guys that had they were using, one had blue gloves, the other one had red gloves, and they were fighting, but without actually making physical contact with each
Yeah, it
other.
was the boxing ring and a little light would show up and it would hit.
Yeah,
Like the.
so I was thinking it was like Rock 'em Sock 'em Robots or something.
Yeah, it was, except they never had any physical contact, but they'd feel it. But the one thing that was even better than that was the judo. The one where they would actually have like the gloves and they would flip each other, but they would take turns doing it.
Yeah, I think that's what I was trying to describe. Yeah, that was
That
really weird.
was weird and awesome at the same time. It was goofy. And then you had the like the guys that were on the ropes and they had to like walk down the rope backwards. And then they had the ice sledding, except it was in a spaceship. It was crazy.
Well, it was really weird, definitely.
But it was very interesting 'cause back in this time frame, you'd hear stories of the Olympics and people from Russia or other countries defecting to the US. During the Olympics or after the Olympics. And
Right, yeah, this.
that's what this plot was. It was a couple that was in love, and the one guy, the high jumper, he couldn't leave. In other words, he was a prisoner of his own planet, essentially, or wherever he was representing. He could not leave, or they would kill him. In other words, it was
Right.
kind of like a dictatorship and a political thing. He couldn't leave, but he was in love with this girl. They had seen each other every 4 years, I guess, during the Olympics. And this time they were going to try to defect, and that was their plot. And there was a lot of jealousy. There was a weird scene in there. I don't know if you liked it as much as I did, but it was hilarious when Buck, they get in that ice glider, right?
All right.
It's just such a weird scene. And the other thing that was interesting about this is that girl that played that character, she's a Young and the Restless person, so Barb actually like stopped the player and took pictures of her so she could send it to her mom because her mom loves to watch Young and the Restless.
Nice. Yeah, Judith Chapman, the actress's name is.
Yeah, she's beautiful, absolutely
Yeah,
beautiful.
I was not I when I looked her up and I saw pictures of her as an older woman I recognized her. But I never seen her looking this young before. I never saw her from back in the day. But yeah, the character she plays is Lara Tizian, and then her boyfriend's name is Jorax Leet. And that's kind of funny to me because Leet's become like a geek thing to say, you know. But yeah, the planet he's from is called Lozaria. And it's like a real repressive world, and he actually has like they have technology in Lazaria where they can like they have implants in their brains and the athletes so they can control them. It's almost like I would feel like at the time in 1980, like it's almost like a futuristic version of how the US saw saw Russia at the time, you know. Or the Soviet Union specifically. But like you said, yeah, they're definitely drawing some from the tensions that would arise from the Olympic Games.
So that was the main plot, but Buck gets himself involved because he's going to be an announcer, or he's going to announce or introduce something at the Olympic Games, and he has to try to take Wilma with her, and Wilma says, "No, I got too much shit to do. I got this, and that." I thought that was interesting because I kind of wanted her to go there, but then she eventually, I thought they were just going to write her out of the plot at that point, and they ended up keeping her in the plot, which I liked. Yeah, don't write her out, please.
Like,
But
no. Well.
Buck gets there, and then he meets this Leet guy, and the Leet guy is very abrasive, and he's like, "I can't talk to you. I'm not supposed to talk to strangers," and all this stuff. And Buck's like, "Well, tell me what's going on." And then he gets like this pulse in his brain. It's like, bzzz! He gets like shocked by one of the guys, from that planet, and he gets like this brain, and gets this huge headache. And Buck's like, "What's wrong? I can help you." And he's, "No, just get away from me." And then the girl that's his girlfriend comes out of nowhere and sees this Buck guy, and she like bonds with him and says, "Will you go on this ride with me in the snow sled?" And it was a weird thing because I almost thought, like, why is she coming on to Buck? Like, she was getting like sexual. She almost looked like she was gonna come, like at one point when they're in the ship together. And Buck, she goes, "You're such a beautiful man." And Buck is like, "Well, thank you. You're a pretty beautiful woman too." I just thought
Yeah.
the dialogue was freaking hilarious. This
was
is not a
pretty.
comedy. This is not a comedy, but it was hilarious.
Yeah, they're pretty tight quarters. It's like her event it's called the Astro Sled, and her event was to drive those. It's almost as if it was a futuristic one person bobsled, but then she crammed an extra person in there with her. Like, I mean, they're like as intimate as you would be on a motorcycle with somebody, and probably more.
And even more so because she has that one controller and she's driving it for most of it. And
Yeah.
then she says, "Well, why don't you get the control?" So he's got like his arms around her trying to control this ice glider.
Yeah,
And
it's all enclosed and private and dark and stuff.
it's kind of like they get real sexual, and then she says, "Well, I need to tell you something." And then she kind of breaks the story to him about like her being in love with somebody else. It was just really weird because it looked, instead of seeking his help in the ship, it looked like they were going to get it on.
Yeah, I was wondering what she was up to there.
It like went a 360, didn't it? I mean, like It went a 180. It was going one direction, then it flipped over, started going the other direction.
Yeah, see, recognize them as somebody that's capable and probably can help them out.
But she
But
used her sexual ways, I guess, to get to him, to
to
try
get
to
his
get his
attention
help.
quick, yeah. And luckily Buck's a good
The
guy.
way that thing slid, too, it was interesting because it was like you're in space, but you have like, if you hit the side of it, you could see like white ice, and it had like this emulation of sliding. Like you were actually sliding. Did you ever play the Atari Ice Racers? It was like a racing game, but you would race with the paddle. And the thing that was interesting about the racing game is you would feel like slide if you were racing on ice. Like you'd have to turn early or do like kind of funky turns if you wanted to turn around the ice, whereas if you did a straight track, it was like straightforward.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if I played that game, but I know what you're talking about. They have like the physics for ice.
Yeah.
I know, like in the like for me, it makes me think of Mario games where you'd have ice levels and the character would slip around a lot and it'd be harder to jump. But
Yeah, so after that scene, she explains to Buck, this is what's going on. Can you help us? And he's like, yes, I'm. And then this is where it got political. He like calls back to Earth and says, can we get some help in getting this guy to defect? So then it became the defect plot. And then they bring this other Olympian who had defected in the past, and they were like, can we pick your brain? Dr. Ewer and Wilma were like, can we pick your brain to see what we could do to help Buck out? And like he's giving him hints and says, well, this guy, he's a horny dude. So you just know that they're setting Wilma up. Wilma's gotta go undercover and get over there. I was trying to find pictures of her on the interwebs with her outfit, but I should have just taken one, but I
She's
couldn't.
got like a blonde wig.
Yeah, like a blonde wig, and she's wearing short shorts and a little crop top. But she goes undercover, and her whole thing is to try to steal a device that is linked to that guy's brain that could actually. He's actually got a bomb in his brain, and if they hit this device over, a certain distance, it will cause that pulse to go to his brain, and it essentially he'll implode.
Yeah. The dude that Wilma was trying to get close to, his name's Alaric. He's not in charge, but he's in charge of the operation there at the Olympics. He's got some higher ups at Losaria that he works for, but I recognize him as the actor that played him was Nicholas Coster. And he was also, I don't know him from these, but he was also on a lot of soaps. But I again, it was an actor that when I looked at the picture, a more current picture of him as an older guy, I recognized him, not so much as he is in this episode. I'm not really sure what I recognize him from, but I think it might have been the Facts of Life because he was on the Facts of Life for
A
a good portion of it.
reoccurring character. And he looked really familiar. I thought it was just, I traced him to somebody I work with. He looks exactly like that. But Barb had known, she said he's also in soap. So like, I never watched soaps. Sometimes I was forced to watch General Hospital when my grandma was taking care of me. When Rick Springfield was in there. But it was more like a side thing. Like I try to keep busy with a toy or something while that crap was on. And that one and All My Children shows she would always watch. And I knew of them and I knew of the characters in them, but I never paid attention to what was going on. I was too young to care anyway.
Yeah, for me too. I think the heights of their popularity, but I wasn't really. But yeah, I mean, I think he's also just one of those actors that's just been tons of stuff. But yeah, he has the weakness for women that Wilma gets close to him by showing up at his And there is an explanation of like who she is. Like she's, I didn't get the specifics of it, but it seemed to amount to her being someone that's there for the Olympics, is like trying to make some money off the fact that it's the Olympics or something, but that she's heard about him and is impressed with him, or that he's a someone important from this area. Basically, plays to his ego to get close to him, because they want to try to get a detonator away from him, because they know that the elite has the bomb in his brain. It's not just a threat to him, but anybody that's near him at the time that they detonate it. But I thought it was interesting that they are kind of unsuccessful. They, Buck and his group, they make a few attempts at overcoming this situation and have to.
Hello. There goes Skype again. God dang it. Hello, 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 hello. There you are.
Yeah.
I lost you for a few seconds.
Oh
I was
boy.
cussing at Skype there for a second. It was like 4 seconds.
Okay. But ultimately they have some trouble with their initial attempts to overcome the situation. And what is he doing? Sorry. My cat finally decided to show up.
Hanging from the
He's
ceiling. No.
Yeah, he got in my lap, and now Kara's doing measurements of the blinds on the
Ah.
window behind me, so she's like almost standing on my head.
The cat wants to jump on the
Too
ledge.
many distractions. I can't. Yeah,
I can't talk about Buck
I can't
Rogers
talk
with a
about Buck
cat on my
Rogers
hat.
in these conditions.
There's a cat on my hat.
Cat on my hat, a wife standing on my neck. Literally. But anyways, so eventually Alaric catches on to what's going on. He figures out that Wilma is not who she says that she is.
Well, because she invite he says, "Let me meet you at that place," and the other guy shows up and he's like, "Why are you in Buck Rogers's quarters?"
All right.
That wasn't such a good plan. Meet me at Buck's apartment. But then he's stupid. That other guy, he's kind of like just he doesn't have a lot of he can't put two and two together because Wilma like, "Come on, baby." Like he tries to hit on her. He's like, "Maybe you can make
Yeah.
up to me or something." And then she just karate chops him and gets out
Yeah.
of there. And then the cool thing is they have to like get him out of there before the pulse can hit his brain and he'll blow up. So the only thing that I didn't understand, and maybe you can explain to me, is they go into this like ice sled arena with the starship. So they get into the Buck Rogers ship and they try to catch up to it, but how did they open up a stargate within that course?
I have no idea. I can't help
Because
you.
they're in that course, they catch up to the ship, they get a tractor beam, and then they hit the Stargate, and then they're back at Earth. And they've rescued everybody. But I couldn't figure out for the life of me, they're in this course and they're hitting walls and stuff because the starship is so big and it's way bigger than the ice sled, you know? And they're hitting walls left and right, trying to go in it with Twiggy. Twiggy's in there, Wilma's in there, and they have like so many seconds because they're essentially trying to beat the signal that's going to his brain.
Yeah, it was kind of a cool action sequence, but.
It's actually a cool concept. In other
Right,
words,
that's what I
they're
mean.
actually trying to beat the signal that's going to blow that guy's brains out. And by the time they hit the Stargate, that's not even in the, it'll never get through the Stargate, the signal. So it's like your garage door opener. You can only hit it from, maybe the beginning of your street. They get out the Stargate, they won't be able to blow his brains out. I wonder if they ever surgically remove it. That would be interesting.
The untold story of Jorax Leet,
Yeah, 'cause it's still in his head.
living bomb.
Yeah, the human bomb.
Yeah, you maybe could write some Buck Rogers fan fiction where you explain like how the surgery done to Jorax Leet's brain.
There was
But
that one cool scene too where those boxers just decided to go after Leet and Buck for no apparent reason.
yeah.
What was
Or
their
when
reason? What was their reason?
well, there was an earlier thing where Twiggy got between two of them,
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
they're like, pick on somebody your own side, like who, how about me, and Twiggy's just standing off to the side like beady beady beady.
The other thing interesting to note is one of the other high jumpers, he looked like a scrawny old dude that was bald. Like he had lost all his hair. He looked like a George Costanza from Seinfeld that was doing the high jump. Except he wasn't as stocky. He was real scrawny.
Yeah.
He was competing against Leet. I'm like, can't you get a little more athletic
They
guy to do this?
ran out of extras, appropriate extras. The other thing was interesting was that Dr. Theophilus came with them this time. A lot of times he stays behind, but this time he was there. Twiggy had him around his neck the whole episode, and
Yeah.
he chimed in on some stuff. He didn't do a whole lot, but for whatever reason, he came along for the Olympics. Maybe he's just a fan or whatever.
He had part of the plan, but I don't think they needed to use him at all. That was the only thing they had mentioned.
But Jorax, he wins the medal, and one of the things that kind of clues the Lozarians in that there's a plot is that he doesn't show up to accept the medal. He disappears because that's when they're trying to make their move. And that's what lets the Lazarians know that they had their suspicions prior to that, but they were definitely knew at this point something was up.
Right.
So.
So we had one question from this morning's from Andrew Shaw, and he says, "What is the one book, single issue, or trade that your collection is missing, but you've been unable to find?" Huh. I think you
Yeah, I
could
just.
find. I think you could find anything as long as you really have the money.
That is kind of more the issue nowadays with the internet. It's like to find the right price point. Because I mean, for me, I'm not a huge collector in terms of issues, and amassing a lot of stuff. But I mean, I tend to go for the economic value and purchase stuff. If I get stuff in paper, a lot of times it's stuff that's not real costly. But for a long time, I've been slowly working on pretty much complete Volume 2 of The Flash, including like one shots and side stuff and the annuals and all that extra stuff. And I'm pretty much done, except for if you count, there was a
Hardcover.
one, no, I mean, there's a one half issue, that Wizard put out, or 0.5, whatever you want to call it. I think they did it as one half. I don't have that yet, and it's not that expensive or anything, but I don't really want to spend much at all on it.
Yeah, you just want to find it in a dollar bin or.
So I mean, I haven't really pulled the trigger. Like, I don't want to spend like $10 on it or more, just because I don't think it's that substantial of an issue.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is. I would like to have it because they did it when Geoff Johns was on the book, and I do see that they've included it, I think, in one of the omnibuses that Clex has run. But for a long time, I needed that, and then I needed one issue from that little short run after Mark Waid, where Grant Morrison was on the book with Mark Millar. But I did finally get that. So I don't think there's really anything else I need besides that Wizard Half issue that I'll have to just pull the trigger on some point just to have it be complete. But
I think the only two that I could say elude me, and they're just elude me because of price, and I can't find what I want when I want it, is Daredevil number one. I almost have a full Daredevil collection, and when I say that, I mean all the volumes.
Wow,
I'm
that's
missing
cool.
about 30 issues in the entirety, and some of them are really early. So Daredevil one, I would try to find like a very good copy that's a reasonable price. Like I'm not looking for a mint copy. I just want to complete it. And then the other one I want really bad is, because I love the character so much, is the first appearance of Deadshot, which is in a very early Batman issue. And that one's a little harder to find. Like, you very seldom do you see it on eBay or anything else, much less in a condition that's affordable. So yeah, those are the two that are kind of eluding me.
There's a couple of other weird ones that aren't expensive or anything. It's just the quantity of them. I mean, they're a little more expensive than an equivalent from the same era, just because there's like a low print run or something. Like I have all of the Young All-Stars issues except for the very last one, which is I think issue 31.
Yeah, those last issues, those almost in every run, especially like they're hard to get. Or sometimes you'll, and they're not that they're expensive, they're just not that, they didn't print a lot of copies for whatever reason. And I guess a lot of people don't want to sell, they're maybe they're completists and want to keep their Young All-Stars, but they're harder to find.
So yeah, it's just like a matter of finding the right situation, because I mean, I've looked, there's some, shops online that might have it, but I don't want to buy just that issue and pay to ship just that issue. And I look at other stuff that they'd have, and they might not maybe have a bunch of stuff I'm looking for or something, or it just, like, the right scenario hasn't come up yet. I don't want it so bad that I'll just go and buy the first one available and spend an extra $5 or $6 just to have one issue shipped to me, So it's just more of a matter of I'll get it when the right situation presents itself. There's a couple others like that. I think I'm down to maybe one or two All-Star Squadron issues that I don't have that are kind of the same situation. Stuff like that there's just like weird, a lot of times, especially with shorter run series, like 30, 40 issues, if they got canceled, people didn't order as much or something.
There's the first appearance of Superboy Prime in DC Comics Presents. I can't remember the issue number, but it's one of those ones that was a crossover with Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah, I found that a couple months
I
ago.
have trouble finding that one. Like, I know I can go and spend money and find it. But I'm talking about like when you're going through the boxes and you're looking for a book. That one's hard to find, and a lot of the ones that are the Crisis tie-ins, or like your Millennium tie-ins or any of those weird ones, they're kind of hard to find.
Yeah, I got lucky with that one. But the copy I got is a little beat up. But I did find it in a
Yeah,
dollar bin.
that's good.
And I just happen to know what it was, it's not the greatest copy, but I was like, for a dollar, I knew it wasn't an, I knew it was a hard to find issue.
Plus, it's a Crisis tie-in. Those are great to pick up if
It's a
you can
cool
find them.
story, yeah, actually. But
So, just a quick shout out to Andrew Shaw. He's in Australia, and in the Facebooks, I don't know, maybe about a year ago, I had posted a thing saying, "God, I'm only missing 3 issues of Savage Dragon," or maybe it was 4 issues at the time. And he actually completed my run minus 1 issue. because he was getting
Nice.
rid of his, and he didn't ask for anything like shipping or anything, and shipping is not cheap when you're shipping from Australia. So that was really cool to I only have one issue to go on Savage Dragon, and I'll eventually fill that. Matter of fact, I'm almost positive I have it. It's just not in my inventory. In other words, I think I bought that issue just because I know the cover so well, and it's either not in my inventory or in the long box by itself, you know, like hasn't been merged with the other collection. But yeah. So that was it. We can wrap this guy up.
Can wrap it up,
Put it up.
the new married man
Yeah, the
issue,
new
or the new
married
married
man.
man era of Retrocast.
And maybe next year for your first year anniversary, you can go to Baltimore.
Yeah,
I'll go.
that's funny. I said months ago, I said, well, we're getting married this year at the same time as Baltimore Con, but it'll just this year, obviously, it'll just be an issue, and then in the future, it won't be a big deal or whatever. And Kara looked at me like, well, it will be our anniversary. And I was like, I totally just was not even thinking. I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, but Baltimore is going to run late next year. I think it's towards the end of September.
Yeah, that was part of it too, where
So
like,
you will be able to celebrate your anniversary and then go to Baltimore. See how that works?
right, yeah. And I mean, she was kind of just laughing at my
Remark.
boneheadedness, but she's like, well, obviously depending on when it falls,
Yeah.
and it's not a big deal if you want to, do that sometimes or whatever,
Yeah. Can't
but
wait
yeah, it's kind of funny that it didn't click
that
for
you
me.
get to go to either Heroes or Baltimore. That'd be awesome.
I'm already planning ahead now. I mean, I was actually thinking about it yesterday, how I'm just gonna make sure ahead of time, like plan way ahead of time to make it happen next year for sure. So
Cool beans. All right.
until then.
Until then, you can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com and search for the retro episodes. You can also leave comments there. We're also on Facebook under Geek Brunch Podcast. You could click the like button and follow the episode threads there and any various posts that we post there. Chris is also doing his cosmic treadmill clips and he posts them on there. Don't you post them on there? I can't remember the last one you posted on DC Noise, or I think
Actually,
Daryl did.
I think Daryl did it, yeah,
Yeah.
which is awesome. But
I know you post them on the Taylor Network for sure. That's
yeah,
where
well,
you always see them.
that's where they're published, actually,
Yeah.
the Taylor Network. I put a link to them up on my blog and stuff, but I send them to Amy, and Amy posts them, and she usually does a link on Facebook to them.
Yeah. So
So.
you can find them there. We're on the Twitters at MythMakingETC. That's Chris's, and I'm at Mike Myers Brunch. We have emails at MythMakingETC@gmail.com. Is that right? Yep. And mine is, I never send you email. That's why it's
No, I
puzzled
don't.
by it, even though it's simple. Mine is Mike@comicbooknoise.com. And leave an iTunes review. We'd appreciate those. And
Definitely.
leave us feedback. We appreciate David always listening to the episode and following along, especially with the Buck Rogers episodes.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So, anything else I missed?
I don't think so. Dusty, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Meow.
You want to say any? Do you want to finally make a noise for Alan? I
Not
gotta catch him when he's hungry.
yeah.
About like 2 hours from now, he'll start asking for his 4:30 dinner,
Yeah.
which 2 hours from now is not 4:30, from when I'm saying this. And
Yeah.
I'll be like, "Meow, meow, meow." Like little bastard.
Right.
Okay.
All right, well, you have a good
Yeah,
Sunday. Got to go watch the Bills. Do they play today or is it Monday? It's today, right?
man, I can't like I'm still adjusting the fact that it's fall,
Yeah.
because the wedding was kind of a distraction to me, and I went back to work after being off and school had started, and I was just like, what the hell is
Just
going on?
happened. I lost 2 months and I've been in this ice pod frozen.
Yeah. But yeah, they play today, I think it's a 1 o'clock game.
Yeah.
So it's starting.
All right.
Well, 1 o'clock Eastern.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Alrighty.
And see ya. Have a good Sunday.
You too.
Bye.
Adios.